Hello, hello, hello. Here's Marlanka with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga. What is the Atman itself but an eternal and fundamental way of looking at things, the essentiality of all being in itself unknowable, neti neti? Therefore, the later Buddhists declared that the Atman itself did not exist and arrived at ultimate nothingness. A barren and foolish conclusion, since nothingness itself is only a sanskara. Nevertheless, it is certain that the great mass of our habitual conceptions are not only temporary, but imperfect and misleading. We must escape from these imperfections and take our stand on that which is true and lasting. But in order to find out what in our conceptions is true and lasting, we must question all alike, rigorously and impartially. The necessity of such a process, not for India, but for all humanity, has been recognized by leading European thinkers. It was what Carlyle meant when he spoke of swallowing all formulas. It was the process by which Goethe helped to reinvigorate European thinking. But in Europe, the stream is running dry before it has reached its sea. Europe has for some time ceased to produce original thinkers, though it still produces original mechanicians. Science preserves her freedom of inquiry in details, in the mint and anise and cumin of the world's processes. But, bound hand and foot in the formulas of the past, she is growing helpless for great ideas and sound generalizations. She sits contented with her treasures. She has combed all the pebbles on the seashore and examined the shoreward gulfs and bays. Of the oceans beyond and their undiscovered continents, she cries scornfully, "They are a dream. There is nothing there but mist mistaken for land, or a waste of the same waters that we've already here examined." Europe is becoming stereotyped and unprogressive. She is fruitful only of new and ever-multiplying luxuries and of feverish, fiery, and ineffective changes in her political and social machinery. China, Japan, and the Muslim states are sliding into a blind European initiativeness. In India alone, there is self-contained, dormant, the energy and the invincible spiritual individuality which can yet arise and break her own and the world's fetters. It is true that original thinking makes for original acting, and therefore a caution is necessary. We must be careful that our thinking is not only original, but thorough before we even initiate action. To run away with an isolated original idea, or, charmed with its newness and vigor, to ride it into the field of action, is to make of ourselves cranks, eccentrics. This world, this society, these nations and their civilizations are not simple existences, but complex, intricate, the result of a great organic growth in many centuries, sometimes in many millenniums. We should not deal with them after snatching at a few hurried generalizations or in the gust and fury of a stiff fanaticism. We must first be sure that our new thought is wide and strong-winged enough, our thoughts large enough, our natures mighty enough to deal with those vastnesses. We must be careful, too, to comprehend what we destroy. And destroy we must not, unless we have a greater and more perfect thing to put in the place even of a crumbling and moldering antiquity. To tear down Hindu society in the spirit of the social reformers, or European society in the spirit of the philosophical or unphilosophical anarchists, would be to destroy order and substitute a licentious confusion. If we carefully remember these cautions, there is no harm in original thinking, even of the boldest and most merciless novelty. I may, for example, attack unsparingly the prevailing system of justice and punishment as extraordinarily senseless and evil, even if I have no new system ready-made to put in as its successor. But I must have no wish to destroy it, senseless and evil though it be, until our new system is ready. For it fills a place, the vacancy of which the spirit that uplifts and supports our human welfare would greatly abhor. I may expose, too, the weaknesses and narrownesses of an existing form of religion, even if I have no new and better form to preach of my own. But I must not so rage against those weaknesses as to destroy all religious faith. And I should remember before the end of my criticism that even a bad religion is better than no religion. That it is wiser to worship energy in my surroundings with the African savage than to be dead to all faith and all spirituality, like the drunkards of a little knowledge. For even in that animal and unintelligent worship, there is a spark of the divine fire which keeps humanity living. While the cultured imperial Roman or the luxurious modern wealth-gatherer and body-worshipper drags his kind into a straight and well-built road which is so broad only to lead more easily to a mighty perdition. Otherwise, there is no harm in spreading dissatisfaction with fetish worship or refusing praise to an ancient and cruel folly. We need not be troubled if our thinking is condemned as too radical or even as reckless and revolutionary. For the success of revolutionary thought always means that nature has need of one of her cataclysms. Even otherwise, she will make of it whatever modified use is best for our present humanity. In thought, as in deeds, to the thinking we have a right. The result belongs to the wise and active power of God that stands over us and in us, originating, cherishing, indefatigably dissolving and remolding man and spirit in the progressive harmonies of his universe. Let us only strive that our light should be clear, diffused and steady, not either darkness or a narrow glare and merely violent luster. And if we cannot compass that ideal, still it is better to think than to cease from thinking. For even out of darkness the day is born, and lightning has its uses. We've had recently in India a great abundance of speculations on the real causes of that gradual decline and final arrest which Indian civilization, no less than European, suffered during the Middle Ages. The arrest was neither so sudden as in Europe nor so complete, but its effect on our nation, like the undermining activity of a slow poison, was all the more profoundly destructive, pervasive, hard to remedy, difficult to expel. At a certain period, we entered into a decline, splendid at first like a long and gorgeous sunset, afterwards more and more somber, till the darkness closed in. And if our sky was strewn with stars of great number and brilliance, it was only a vast decay, confusion, and inertia that they lighted and emphasized with their rays. We have, most of us, our chosen explanation of this dolorous phenomenon. The patriot attributes our decline to the ravages of foreign invasion and the benumbing influences of foreign rule. The disciple of European materialism, he finds out the enemy, the evil, the fount and origin of all our ills in our religions and its time-honored social self-expression. Such explanations, like most human thoughts, have their bright side of truth as well as their obscure side of error. But they are not, in any case, the result of impartial thinking. Man may be, as he has been defined, a reasoning animal. But it's necessary to add that he is, for the most part, a very badly reasoning animal. He does not ordinarily think for the sake of finding out the truth, but much more for the satisfaction of his mental preferences and emotional tendencies. His conclusions spring from his preferences, prejudices, passions, and his reasoning and logic paraded to justify them are only a specious process or a formal mask for his own covert approach to an upshot previously necessitated by his heart or by his temperament. When we are awakened from our modern illusions, as we have been awakened from our medieval superstitions, we shall find that the intellectual conclusions of the rationalist, for all their pomp and profuse apparatus of scrupulous inquiry, were as much dogmas as those former dicta of Pope and theologian, which confessed without shame their simple basis in the negation of reason. Much more do all those current opinions demand scrutiny and modification, which express our personal view of things and rest patently on a partial and partisan view, or have been justified by preferential selection of the few data that suited our foregone and desired conclusion. It is always best, therefore, to scrutinize very narrowly those bare, trenchant explanations which so easily satisfy the pugnacious animal in our intellects. When we have admitted that this small part of the truth on which they seize, we should always look for the large part which they have missed. Especially is it right when there are subjective movements and causes of a considerable extent and complexity behind the phenomena we have to observe, and to distrust facile, simple, and rapid solutions. Let us pause at this point for today, to be continued with the next episode. May we take it to heart to be impartial thinkers. Signing off for today, Marlenka. Thanks for listening.
This is Orville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.